It's the 25th of November 2011, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a radio program and podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions: is a new American law threatening freedom, or can we wash our hands of the threat of SOPA? Are we any closer to curing cancer, or do we still have years of charity muggers to go? If Marcus Chown tweets the universe, will the universe follow him back? If former MP Chris Mullin's diaries make a good play, would they make a good video game? And do we actually exist, or does the entire universe actually revolve around Sean Ellis? But first, can anything the Russians do, the Americans do better? We start this week with another rover. That's right, just 1 week after we covered the Phobos Grunt mission, another one has turned up. They're a bit like buses, or recessions. But will this latest mission be any more successful than Phobos Grunt, which is still milling around somewhere above the Earth, destroying absolutely no stereotypes about Russian engineering? So what's the big deal with this one, and what's it looking for? And can they take TV's Nick Knowles with them? Kash Farouk has been speaking to Claire Cousins to find out.
Following the recent launch of the Russian Phobos Grunt spacecraft, there is another Mars mission about to launch. This time, it is the turn of NASA's Mars Science Laboratory. This isn't a coincidence, by the way. A Martian year lasts 779.96 Earth days, and hence, the so-called minimum energy launch windows for missions to Mars occur at intervals of about 780 days, and we are bang in the middle of one of those windows right now. I caught up with UCL's Dr. Claire Cousins to discuss MSL and the Curiosity rover. Can we start with an explanation of what the Mars Science Laboratory is and how it relates to Mars Curiosity rover?
Well, Mars Science Laboratory is the overarching mission. And then the Curiosity part itself is actually the name of the rover. So it's Mars Curiosity, which is part of the Mars Science Laboratory mission. And it's the rover Curiosity, which will be actually being sent to the surface of Mars in late November this year.
Okay, and what's been your involvement with the mission?
So my involvement in the mission has been sort of very much on the side. I've been involved in an expedition called AMAZE, which stands for Arctic Mars Analog Svalbard Expedition. This is a joint NASA and ESA expedition which goes to Svalbard every summer, every August, and it tests a whole bunch of rover instrumentation. This includes both Mars Science Laboratory instruments and also those for the European Space Agency's ExoMars rover as well. Which is the rover that I'm working on. So whilst I'm involved in ExoMars, I've not been working on MSL itself, but I have been involved in, you know, working in the field with all the people who are testing the instrumentation, and we all work together as a team as well to sort of to help further Mars research.
And can you tell me anything about the Curiosity rover, how it differs from the rovers that are already on Mars?
Yes. No, well, the main thing really is that it's absolutely enormous. As far as rovers go, it's by far the biggest one that's ever been sent to the surface of Mars. It weighs about 900 kilograms, and it's essentially the size of a kind of like a small car, like a Mini Cooper, for example. So, and the result of this huge size of the rover means that there's so many more instruments that can be incorporated into it, both because of its size and also the extra weight allowance for this as well. And this allows for an arm to be included as well, which has sort of three joints like a human arm. And upon this arm, there's a whole bunch of instruments, contact instruments to measure things directly on the surfaces of rocks, as well as sample retrieval and preparation as well to ingest samples and rocks into the rover itself for internal analysis.
What are the main goals of the mission? It's more a geological mission, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, geology sort of as a subject really is looking back into the past of a planetary body exactly the same way that geologists do on Earth. So looking at sediments, looking at the rock record on Mars will tell us an awful amount of information, including changes in the climate over the history of Mars, also the activity of liquid water as well, and what sort of environments existed on the surface of Mars all the way through its 4.6 billion year history.
One of the interesting things I've read about the mission is that a new type of landing technique will be used. Can you tell me about this? Why a new technique was needed?
Basically, the most important thing about this new technique, and it is very sort of novel, you know, something like this has never been done before for any previous mission, but it really does completely win over all the other ones by the fact it's very, very precise compared to the other ones. So when you have a landing site, you have your big landing site, and then and within that you have your landing ellipse. And the size of that landing ellipse is reduced considerably for this new descent system.
the target for the mission is Gale Crater. Can you tell me about this target and what they're expecting or hoping to find there?
Well, Gale Crater is the landing site for MSL, and it has a really big geological diversity in terms of the sediments it contains, the actual stratigraphy that crosses over a very important time in Martian history. And the sort of geography of the area means that Curiosity, the rover, can actually traverse all the way up through a canyon and actually go past all of these sedimentary layers, reading the rock record as it goes and understanding the mineralogy, looking at the geomorphology of the rocks, understanding the environments that these sediments were deposited in, to help work out what the environments might have been like, whether or not they were habitable, for example, and also analysing the rocks for the ingredients for life, so doing like an organic inventory, seeing what organic molecules, carbon molecules are present in the rocks on Mars, and also understanding how much liquid water was actually involved in a lot of these surface processes. Many minerals on the surface of Mars, particularly in Gale Crater, one of the reasons why Gale Crater was chosen, has these hydrated minerals, as they're called. And these are minerals which require liquid water to form. So they're indicative of environments that had a presence of liquid water for a considerable amount of time. So these are the sorts of environments where people think there might have been life once living there. So whilst it's not a life detection mission, it's very much analysing the environments and looking into the past habitability of Mars by looking back into this geological rock record.
And what next for Mars exploration? You already mentioned ExoMars. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, well, ExoMars is due to launch still in 2018. And unlike MSL, this is an actual life detection mission. So it still will be conducting geological analysis of the terrain, because you can't send a life detection mission without understanding the actual environments that you're looking at. And that's where geology always comes in to provide the context for such exploration. But certainly the life detection focus is more looking for signs of extinct, potentially even extant life, by looking for very specific organic molecules, as well as, again, doing a sort of a wider inventory of the organic content of the Martian rocks as well, and using microscopic cameras as well to look for sort of textures, biomorphic textures within the rocks themselves. So it will build on what MSL will hopefully find out, obviously only at Gale Crater, because it's very specific where the rover is going to be going, but it's understanding the rocks there will help to help scientists to extrapolate that data and understand more global processes and therefore environments that would have existed on Mars in the past, which will then help missions like ExoMars look into the rock record for signs of life.
Okay, and finally, when and where is the launch of MSL, and will you be attending?
Well, the launch will be on the 25th of November, hopefully. It'll be launching on an Atlas V rocket, and it's due to land in August 2012. And it's going from Florida. It's going from Kennedy Space Center at Cape Canaveral, and I'm hoping to go. we'll see how that one pans out. But yes, all being well, it will launch on the 25th or shortly after then.
Okay, I think that's a good place to end. Thank you very much.
Okay, no worries.
Since recording this interview, NASA have moved the launch back one day to Saturday, the 26th of November. So, on Saturday at 15:02 GMT, I will be tuning into NASA TV to watch the launch live. Let's hope it doesn't do a Phobos grunt, and we see the Curiosity rover successfully start its journey towards Mars. This is Kash Farouk for the Pod Delusion.
Back to Earth now on the latest draconian attempts to potentially censor the internet. The Stop Online Piracy Act is currently being debated in America and could see websites being blocked without a court saying so. And this has inevitably led to some questions about censorship and denial of freedom of speech. It's ironic, really, that the only sort of freedom of speech I don't like is when people talk in pirate voices. It's a pain in the arse. Here's James Firth with more.
The subject of copyright and the internet is something I've covered in detail here and elsewhere. The question isn't just, should people be able to nick stuff for free, but also, is it really nicking, and can we measure the harm? And can we even, if we wanted to, stop people nicking stuff for free without breaking the internet? The link between the consumer and the price and availability of digital entertainment is complex. Studies have shown people will still pay for a film or album even though a free copy is available. Studies have also shown the availability of free music helps promote an artist's work. But it's the last part of my earlier question that's causing uproar at the moment, How can we stop people sharing copyrighted works without locking down the internet? A range of European countries have varying legal measures to try and combat piracy, from disconnection and censorship to simple warning letters. The UK's ill-fated Digital Economy Act tried to combine all three, but the anti-piracy measures it introduced are now unlikely to become effective until 2013, 3 years after the law was passed, due to a string of legal problems and challenges. France's version is called Hadopi. The French law did eventually take effect, but whether it will dent piracy is anyone's guess. An interesting side effect of the French internet law is the launch of an old-school printed magazine named Pirate, a publication dedicated to file sharing. After buttering up the free speech lobby with a handful of European laws, the lobbyists for the creative industries have returned to the United States, where the Stop Online Piracy Act, or SOPA, is working its way through Congress. I asked San Francisco lawyer Kathy Gellis what all the fuss is about.
SOPA actually attempts to do an awful lot of things. I was reading through it this morning, and it actually does more things than people are even being hysterical about. One of the things I noticed is it creates the position of an intellectual property attaché to be installed at every U.S. embassy and mission around the world to be focused on IP issues in that locale. I haven't seen a lot of discussion about that issue because it doesn't directly implicate the internet, but that's interesting. But what's making people upset is how it interacts with internet content. It puts a tremendous amount of burden on an intermediary, either a domain name host or even an ISP. It allows for websites to be shut down with no due process, no hearing, just on allegations, which obviously makes it ripe for abuse. These are just two of them. I think there's more horrible that will come out as well. But these concerns, even if they were the only things wrong, create tremendous concern. And the implications of all these are also what's alarming people. If you can shut down websites, you're going to essentially break DNS security because people will stop using DNS, and that's going to cause problems. It's going to essentially break the internet and how it's routed and be ripe for exploit by people who don't have good intentions in mind.
So DNS is the domain name system, essentially the internet's address book, and this is separate to the internet service providers, the ISPs, which again are separate to websites like YouTube and Facebook. Why are these problems only coming to light now with SOPA? Isn't there already a US law that deals with copyright takedown, and the internet still works today, right?
Well, there's a couple of levels. There's ISPs and then there's DNS providers, and in many instances they might be one and the same, but it's new to start roping in liability on the DNS providers, and it's putting the ISPs in a position that they hadn't been in before. ISPs had largely been immunized under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act as long as they complied with certain regulations, basically notice and takedown. If somebody alleged that there was infringing material and they acted on that notice, they were okay. And whatever lawsuit ensued, they were not part of it. And this law, on one hand, says we're not touching that whole paradigm, and in another way, from a practical standpoint, completely wrecks that paradigm. So it's also not clear exactly how SOPA will play well with existing law.
SOPA purports to reach worldwide, but technically and legally, it's going to be a challenge to stop people turning to overseas DNS providers. Might there be some unintended consequences if US web users start to bypass SOPA's reach?
The internet architects are throwing up their hands in hysteria because this breaks how the internet is supposed to work. If you start having bypasses, the people who want content are going to be able to get it no matter what, but at what cost? And at what cost to this vibrant community that the internet represents? Some people in their rhetoric, and I think this was even as submitted as testimony at the SOPA hearings, are talking about the internet not just as a thing or a place, but almost a community with its own culture and code, that the spirit of it and its openness of it is as much important as any of the specific information that it should happen to deliver.
So we're establishing that copyright, in its strictest definition, won't survive in a free and open information architecture. Yet, as you've just said, the culture of the internet is reliant on this very same freedom and openness. Is there a third way? Can copyright and openness survive?
I'm not sure if this is where you're going, but I would basically say that the problem is that copyright has lost its way. That the idea of copyright, this is explicit in the U.S. Constitution. Congress gets to pass copyright law in order to promote the progress of science and the useful arts. The only reason we have this statute is to make sure that that happens. Its copyright spirit is all about getting information developed and distributed. The internet actually is the perfect facilitator of that ideal. The problem is over the intervening 200 or so years, that copyright has started to be regarded as a property-like entitlement. And when you start playing a game of, well, my entitlement is worth this and your entitlement is worth that, now we're running into the problems. But if we took copyright law and unwound it back to its historical essence and origin and purpose, I don't think we have a conflict at all.
Copyright has lost its way. Are you also referring to the length of protection and the continual push to expand protection terms?
Well, when you start extending the terms, I mean, this flies directly in the face of our constitutional mandate. It said Congress can go ahead and pass these laws for limited terms. And now all of a sudden we're dealing with life plus 70. This is question whether that's limited. Question also whether that's effective. There was data, I believe, that came up in the Eldred case suggesting that what is actually the most ideal duration of monopolistic protection for the author that would appropriately stimulate the most creativity. And it's not nearly as long as what we came out to. I can't remember the number offhand, but well under 20 years or something along those lines. Now all of a sudden you have things that are so long, it's not inducing any more creativity. It's arguably stifling creativity because it's holding up people's ability to recycle and build upon things because it's behind this copyright fence. And then on top of that, we've been retroactively applying copyright to people who were already dead or people who've already created this. There's no way to incentivize a person to create a work they've already created.
So we're in danger of forgetting that copyright itself is a market intervention originally designed to stimulate creativity and the publishing of information. And now, in an ironic twist, we need another intervention on our modern information publishing architecture to prop up the original analog era intervention. Isn't that madness?
Exactly. And it was done because you're trying to prevent against market failure. If your markets aren't failing, why do you need to do anything? It's copyright that's gone out of whack, not that the internet's gone out of whack. If you unwound copyright to what it was supposed to do, we don't have a conflict.
Kathy Gellis in San Francisco, thank you very much. This is James Firth reporting for The Pod Delusion.
So that all sounds pretty dodgy. It turns out that some people are already working on a way to ensure net neutrality and the like by creating a dark internet, a dark net. It all sounds a bit sinister to me. They should have called it something a bit more friendly, like, you know, I don't know, the David Attenborough net or the kitten net. Or, you know, something like that. I'm workshopping here. Here's Salim Fadli with more.
The internet as we know it is built around a number of assumptions. For example, it assumes that it is primarily composed of fixed machines connected by mostly wired networks. It assumes a vaguely hierarchical network with a relatively small number of high-capacity backbone routers which serve the general public. One of the most important assumptions is that of net neutrality, the idea that the network should be an indiscriminate carrier of information regardless of the source, destination, or nature of the information being transmitted. Some newly proposed legislation threatens to undermine this assumption. In America, the Protect IP Act and the Stop Online Piracy Act propose to regulate the internet by blocking so-called rogue websites. Internet activists have compared this regulation to the Great Firewall of China. If built, it will be the largest and most radical form of censorship ever devised. There's already a great deal of political opposition to this policy. However, some activists have decided to view censorship as a technical problem, one which requires an engineering solution. I spoke with José Manuel from the Darknet project about his community plan to reimagine an internet which could root around any attempt at government censorship. I began by asking José how he began with the Darknet project.
Started it because we believe that the rights about in the internet are being slowly degraded over time. For example, with what happened in Egypt, with the government shutting down social networks because they said it promoted the protest. We want to build a network that is operated by the people and for the people. So this is our way of avoiding censorship, and we truly believe we can achieve true net neutrality.
But there's a more pressing danger, isn't there? The Stop Internet Piracy Act threatens to cut our American friends off from the neutral internet, and that might happen within weeks or months from now.
Sure. This act, for example, the Protect IP, won't cut our rights right out. But, I mean, it will set a precedent, and over time, the rights will get smaller. And sure, I mean, if you don't do anything wrong, you don't have to worry about these new laws. But with time, these new laws will get more invasive, and we believe that our rights are being diminished.
We spoke this year with the founder of the Serval project, who proposed that we should adapt our mobile phones. However, phone operators and vendors tend to modify their devices to make this kind of thing very difficult. So what kind of hardware and software are you proposing that we should use to make a mesh network a practical reality?
We would be using two Wi-Fi radios. One would be for mesh networking and handling the communications between the mesh. One would be for clients like mobile phones or iPads. And the software we would be using would be a routing daemon, which basically handles the communications inside the mesh network. And then we would be using a simple user interface that the mesh node operators can use to configure the node.
So you're talking about taking some software which already exists as open source and maybe bundling it up so that it works with some cheap hardware and give it a more user-friendly interface.
The software already exists and it's really viable, and it's being made by people who know what they're doing. For example, our routing software called Batman, it's really being used in mesh networks over Berlin and whatnot. And what we believe is that these mesh network projects are really not successful because of the user interface. I mean, sure, everybody can learn how to flash a router, but not everybody would do it in a normal condition. So what we were trying to do is basically bundle it up in a way that's very easy to use. And if you pay $50 for the router, then it just works and it handles everything by itself.
I guess where this technology is most needed is not so much quiet neighborhoods like where I live, but in places where the censorship is becoming most obvious. For example, around the Occupy Wall Street protests, where you've obviously got a critical mass of motivated people, but how would you work around other issues such as power constraints or lack of suitable locations for antenna?
We did some calculations, and our mesh nodes would be using about 9 watts of power. We managed to establish that if we used, for example, 1 feet per 1 feet solar panel, we would manage to run this node for 60 hours on normal use. But in situations where power is more restricted, you need to have this way of relying on solar power, for example.
The Zuccotti Park site where the Occupy Wall Street protest is taking place right now is 3,100 square meters. How many mesh nodes do you think you'd need to cover that entire park?
With the right antennas, we could cover the plaza with about 3 nodes placed in strategic locations. However, these are just like figures that basically work in theory. If we had omnidirectional antennas and we placed them in locations where it had a clear view of the people, you know, then maybe we could cover this with 3 nodes. And the deployment would be pretty cheap, because we're talking about like $50 for each node. So our goal is to reach to many people as possible with as few nodes as possible.
You could add additional nodes to give some kind of redundancy.
That you can have as few nodes as possible, but then you can also add as many as you want. Ideally, and what we're using to make the calculations is that if every people in the world had a mesh node, then how it would work, you know? we have to do this kind of questions to design the network and the IP address schemes.
What can our listeners do in order to join or promote or even take advantage of your project? How can they get involved today?
The easiest way to get involved is by visiting our website. Right now, our technology is not ready to roll out and deploy reliably. So we're calling out for programmers, designers, peer people to reach out to Medium. And basically, we think that in 6 months or such time, we would have a technology that it's reliable enough to roll out and start selling boxes.
When we think of revolutionaries, the most obvious image is that of political activists like Gandhi or Martin Luther King. But perhaps the Darknet project is a new form of political revolution, one plotted in computer science departments and basement dens. The Darknet project may be far from complete, but I believe that its dream of an internet completely free of censorship is one that may well come to be. This is Salim Fadli for The Pod Delusion.
Now, there was some good news this week from Macmillan, who announced that the average amount of time people are living after having cancer is increasing. Brilliant, but it did make me wonder, how close are we to actually curing cancer? It seems like we should be making some progress given the amount of time and money thrown at it, so in this next report, Matt Kaiser is going to give a rundown on how things are going. I'm hoping that they're nearly done, so scientists can get to work on more important things, like giving us powers.
Macmillan Cancer Support this week publicised some informative statistics on cancer survival in the UK, the headline message being that, overall, cancer patients are living 6 times longer than 40 years ago. The data do show, however, stark differences between cancer types, with colon cancer patients living on average 17 times longer than 40 years ago, whilst lung cancer patients' median survival has been extended by only 20 weeks over the same period. As someone who works for a cancer charity, I'm often asked, why haven't we found a cure for cancer yet? After all, scientists have been investigating cancer seriously for well over a century, and we spend millions of pounds globally each year. I would first question the term, a cure for cancer. Cancer is really an umbrella term to describe a collection of over 200 diseases that share the common feature of uncontrolled cell proliferation, but that have different tissues of origin, different causes, difference in progression in space and time, etc., etc. But that's not to say that we haven't made huge progress in recent years in detecting, treating and even preventing cancer. Cancer incidence has crept up since the 1970s, but the fact that we're better at diagnosing cancer, less likely to die early from other causes like cardiovascular disease, and changing our societal behaviours like delaying getting pregnant, for instance, can all lead to more recorded cases of cancer. That's what makes Macmillan's focus on survival very encouraging. But as Macmillan points out, the survival data are a mixed bag and progress has been slow in some areas, so we can't stand still. We have greatly improved our basic understanding of the predisposition to many cancers, the variety of causes, the complex interplay of signals that go awry, as well as the spread of tumours that, in the majority of cases, is what actually leads to the patient dying. These findings are being translated into real patient benefit through more effective surgery, chemotherapies and radiotherapies, better lifestyle advice and symptom awareness. But like with most research, the more you find out, the more you realise you didn't know. For example, following huge leaps in technology and knowledge in genome sequencing, scientists are now discovering the importance not only of the underlying genetic sequence, but of how chemical tags on the DNA can alter the levels of gene products in the cell, and how this misregulation of gene expression can lead to a cell becoming cancerous. We're also realising that cancers contain many altered proteins, the immediate environment surrounding a tumour can greatly affect its growth and spread, and tumours can develop resistance to a particular drug treatment, all of which means our magic bullet drug or the cure for cancer is pretty unrealistic. If this is starting to sound a little defeatist, then what is the future for tackling cancer? What are being devised now are more targeted treatments. I mentioned that cancer is a fairly generic term, and it's perhaps a little more generic than we traditionally thought. It turns out that not all breast cancers are the same, not all lung cancers are the same, and so on. In the past, for example, all lung cancer patients would be treated with the same combination of drugs, which would target a particular pathway to stop the cancer cells growing. but some patients have another defect in the cancer cells that means those drugs just don't work. Being able to split patients into those with the additional defect and those without, or stratifying them, will allow clinicians to deliver more effective treatment. These sorts of differences between groups of cancer patients are becoming more and more apparent, and is why Cancer Research UK, together with industrial partners and government, has launched a stratified medicine programme to support this area of research. This stratified medicine approach will be helped enormously by the discovery and development of diagnostic biomarkers, detectable signs in a patient that indicate the presence of a particular type of cancer. This is happening alongside innovations in technology which are improving, complementing and even replacing current therapies. Examples are using nanoparticles to deliver drugs directly to the tumour, antibody-based therapies that improve specificity towards cancerous cells, and cancer vaccines that harness the body's own immune system to fight the cancer. These treatments will not only prove more effective, but will reduce the non-specific toxic effects associated with some of the current blunt instrument chemo and radiotherapies, and will lead to a better quality of life for cancer patients. The focus has also shifted to targeting multiple components, such as trying to hit the tumour itself and its supporting environment, attacking the cancerous cells from all angles. And let's not forget the gains that can still be made by changing behaviour, educating about sun exposure, smoking, risks of hormone replacement therapy, obesity, alcohol intake, and much, much more. In fact, the suspicion is that the reason the UK lags behind other parts of Europe and the US in survival rates is simply due to late diagnosis. The advances made in all areas has led to a more multidisciplinary and collaborative way of working. Biologists, clinicians, chemists, physicists, epidemiologists and mathematicians are coming together to solve fundamental questions and design better therapies. This has and will continue to prompt a culture change within academia and funding bodies. We need to move away from individualist and specialist career trajectories and towards a system of cross-discipline training and supporting teams of researchers to address particular problems. And that's why continued investment is critical in order to capitalise on this extraordinary progress and to tackle those rare and hard-to-beat cancers that Macmillan highlighted. This is Matt Kayser striking an optimistic note for the Pod Delusion.
Now, if you're a regular listener to the Pod Delusion, you're probably the sort of person who likes it when people cite their sources. I know I do. When I was growing up, I'd excitedly tear open my presents on Christmas morning and flip straight to the backs of the books to see the indexes, and I always dreamed of growing up to be a Wikipedia pedant with a big citation needed stamp. But what if, when you went to look up the source of a claim, you were met with a demand to see the source article? In this next report, Pete Haig explains why he thinks this isn't a very good idea. If you'd like to see his sources, head over to the Pod Delusion website and make sure you've got your credit card handy. Here's Pete Haig with more.
Today, I want to talk about the BBC. Anyone listening to this from outside the UK, bear in mind that, despite what I'm going to say, I think the BBC is a great institution, and most people here agree with me. I read a science article on the BBC website, published on the 23rd of November, reporting on a scientific paper that attempted to assign two numeric values to the habitability of other planets, including exoplanets, those orbiting stars other than our own. Both values range from 0 to 1, with 1 being Earth. One index was called the Earth Similarity Index, or ESI, which tries to quantify how much like Earth a planet is in terms of its density, mass, and orbital radius. The Planetary Habitability Index, or PHI, ranks a planet based on such things as its surface composition and whether or not it has a magnetic field to protect it. I had some issues with the science as presented. The article doesn't address the fact that, at the present time, it is utterly impossible to say what the surface or magnetic field of an exoplanet is like, and how the PHI could be calculated. Perhaps the paper stated an error in the PHI value, but this is not mentioned in the BBC article. More alarmingly, the highest rank in the Earth Similarity Index, besides Earth itself, is Gliese 581g, an exoplanet whose very existence is still questioned by astrophysicists, and even if it does exist, like all exoplanets, there is an error in the measurement of its orbital parameters, which influenced the ESI. I don't know if this was poor science reporting or poor science, so I did the reasonable thing and clicked on the link to the paper that had been provided by the BBC article. Instead of being enlightened on the issue, I was asked for $51. An interested reader, being able to see for themselves the published science on which an article is based, is part of good science journalism, and in this case the reader would be required to pay a fee that I think would put off the vast majority of people. I feel that a science article which directs a reader to a pay source is, in a subtle way, advertising that particular science publisher. And even putting aside objections to hiding science behind paywalls, I don't like it when the BBC does that sort of thing. People in the UK pay a licence fee in order to have a media outlet that is free of commercial interests. And although there is almost certainly no intention to do so here, this article does push people towards a commercial interest. I admit, I probably wouldn't be so picky if the nature of this particular commercial interest didn't irk me as much. Charging for access to science is a contentious issue, and given the incredibly large profits the big publishers make without really contributing to research themselves, and the principle that science should be an open and transparent process. Open access in science is quite a complex issue, which I won't fully get into here, but suffice to say that I'm in favour of it. For the moment, I want to focus on the position I think that a public broadcaster should take. It's been suggested to me that I'm a bit biased on this topic. My field of astrophysics is usually good at providing free access to e-prints of papers. Maybe I wouldn't be making this argument if I worked in another field where most work is behind a paywall and would, under my argument, never get talked about on the BBC. I doubt many scientists would like their area of work to be utterly ignored by a prominent part of the media. That's a valid argument, but there has to be a cost-benefit analysis. Is the inconvenience of limiting science reporting worth the benefit of keeping the BBC clear of commercial interests of the science publishers, and the further benefit of using public money to promote open access science? I feel that is worth it, but I accept that I'm in a field that wouldn't be hurt too much by this. I am open to being convinced that this is a fight not worth having, if any of you would like to respond or comment on the Pod Delusion website. I have, by the way, raised this issue with the BBC by email, but at the time of recording, I've not received any response from them. This is Pete Haig, taking on the science paywalls for the Pod Delusion.
Now, can you tweet the universe? Marcus Chown thinks it's possible to distill down everything we know into just a few tweets. And I don't even think he's using Twitlonger. To find out how on earth he managed that, here's Liz Luckendorf.
Marcus Chown, the well-known science writer and broadcaster, has written what I term a delightful new book, written with Dutch science writer Hovert Schilling. The book is called Tweeting the Universe, and indeed does just that. From suns to galaxies to the furthest reaches of where physics has taken us, it is a fact-filled guide to the universe in 140 chapters, filled with 140-character tweets. So how did this all come about? Here's Marcus explaining just that.
Well, it's bizarre, really. It all started on a Caribbean island in 1998, when I got sent by a New Scientist to cover a total eclipse of the sun. And I met this Dutch journalist called Hovert Schilling, who was also covering the total eclipse for a Dutch newspaper. And then we kind of kept in touch, sent Christmas cards. But then, you know, a few years ago, the social networking phenomenon, Twitter, started, and I found that we were fellow tweeters. And he'd actually started tweeting kind of courses on the Big Bang. You know, he would do 10 tweets on, you know, what is the Big Bang or whatever. And then he found a Dutch newspaper got very interested and said, would you like to write a column? So he wrote a column and he got quite a lot of interest. And last Christmas, he emailed me and said, would you like to write an English language book? So really, I have to say, it's Hovert's idea, not mine. And that's how it came about.
Hovert and yourself both talk about and write about science, astronomy and stuff. Did you have to do any kind of in-depth research, or were you just drawing from things you knew and then trying to fit them into a tweet?
Both, really. I thought when Hovert suggested it, I mean, first of all, he suggested it, so I suggested it to my publisher, Faber, which is kind of one of the most old-fashioned and conservative publishers, the last major independent publisher. So I was amazed when they immediately said, yeah, let's do it. And at the time I thought, oh, it's going to be really easy. You know, I mean, I just did something called Solar System for iPad. It's an interactive book and you can you can spin Jupiter with your finger and all that kind of stuff. And in order to fit stories on a single page so that people didn't have to scroll, I had to write everything in 275 words, which was quite hard. So I thought, well, doing a book in tweets, I'm just going down another level, you know. But actually, it turns out to be much, much harder because, you try and tell a story. If there's 10 tweets about what is the Big Bang, you try and tell a story, you try and be humorous if you can, and you try and impart real understanding. And so it turned out to be much more hard work than I thought. And often shaving the tweets, individual tweets, down to 140 characters was much harder than even writing the tweet in the first place.
There's a mixture of the very known facts, and then there's definitely parts where you go, we don't exactly know what's going on here. Was that intentional, or is just, we're trying to cover all of what we know, so some of it we don't obviously know?
Well, that's, to me, is the most exciting thing about science, not what that we know, but what we don't know. If kids are getting into science, the last thing they want to know is that, which is what science teaching often teaches them, is that it's all sewn up, we know it all. The truth is we don't know a lot, and there's a lot of exciting stuff out there to be discovered.
You mentioned quantum mechanics, and you've written a book on quantum mechanics. Would you want to fix that into a tweetable length?
Well, I really would. I really, really, really would. And I've actually suggested it to my publisher, because I would like to tweet the really hard stuff.
Ooh.
I'd really like to tweet quantum electrodynamics.
That's nearly 140 characters just to learn.
Well, yeah. I'd really like to have a go at tweeting the really, really hard, deep physics. That would be a real challenge to try and distill really deep, complex physics into tweets.
A lot of my favourite things in the book was not necessarily, that it was about tweets, was just the things that you put in it that you forgot or you didn't know, but were just, interesting facts, like subatomic particles going through eyes of astronauts.
Right, and creating flashes of light.
Yes.
Yeah, and they didn't mention that for many, many years afterwards, because they thought they would be accused of being nuts. We now know that their eye was acting like a particle detector. When we try and detect things like neutrinos, we use a giant vat of water in a mine, and occasionally a neutrino interacts with a proton in the water and creates a flash of light. Well, something pretty similar was happening in the eyes of astronauts, but they didn't like to mention it.
But did you have any absolute favourite facts that you wanted to get in, or?
I do. Yeah, absolutely. I do like lots of weird things. I like the fact that you can fit the entire human race in the volume of a sugar cube, which I've mentioned before, but it gives you some idea of the emptiness of matter. We think of an atom as a tiny planetary system with electrons orbiting a central nucleus, but that doesn't give you any idea of how far away the electrons are compared to the nucleus. And it turns out that the matter that you're made of, I can tell you the percentage of empty space, and it's 99.999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999 In all the people in the world, you could fit the human race in the volume of a sugar cube. And there are objects out in space like that. They're called neutron stars. They are the collapsed remnant of a supernova explosion. I mean, paradoxically, when a star blows itself up, its core implodes. And if you could go to one and dig out a chunk the size of a sugar cube, it would indeed weigh as much as the human race.
Well, to kind of put these all together, how do you see these, like Twitter and iPad apps and stuff, aiding science communication?
Well, they're just another vehicle. I think historically, you know, we think of a book as something made out of paper. And I think we've now come to realise that we need a more abstract and more general definition. And if there's a project, you know, if it's science communication or something, you need to think to yourself, what is the best vehicle? You know, is it a phone app? Is it a book? Is it an iPad app? So really, I don't really see this as a fundamental change at all. But if you look at the app, I mean, when I was at school, you know, I'd go to the library and I'd maybe get an astronomy book because I was a bit boring. And, you know, and there'd be an artist's impression of what it was like on Mars, you know. And really, you'd have to use your imagination to know what it's like. And we've become spoiled. You know, at the time of Apollo, if you watched the TV news, they would show you the whole mission. Mm. Now we send these probes, which like Cassini, which go to Saturn, and we're very lucky if we ever see like 10 seconds at the end of the 10 o'clock news.
That was actually my last question. We're basically spoiled by all these images and probes, and now we get, you know, more Mars rovers and stuff, and the challenge of, you know, basically communicating all that, because there's so much stuff out there.
That is a difficulty, but I try my best. I was very fortunate. I went to an American university. I went to Caltech, and I was taught by people like Richard Feynman. I was very, very lucky, and I felt really privileged to learn lots of amazing things. And what I try and do is communicate some of the you know, the amazement that I felt just to ordinary people. And I actually, I'm like most people. Feynman was my hero, but his criterion of whether he understood anything was whether he could explain it to anyone else. You know, somebody waiting for a bus, and that's unusual. And again, that's my criterion of understanding. So when I try and write about science, I'm really trying to wrestle with it and understand it myself. But fortunately, that overlaps with ordinary people trying to understand it as well. So I'm actually doing it for me, but hopefully other people get benefit as well.
Oh, excellent. Well, that was an amazing interview. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for asking me.
If you'd like to read the book, or, given it's that time of year, gift it to the Twitter fiend in your life, just follow the links on the Poddelusion website. You can also find links to the Solar System app and the longer interview, all at poddelusion.co.uk. This has been Liz Lichtendorf for the Poddelusion.
Now, an intriguing new play opened this week in London at the Soho Theatre. A Walk on Part is based on the diaries of the former Labour MP Chris Mullin. It's a bit like Mamma Mia, but with less ABBA and more Prezza. Whilst not a major cabinet member or anything like that, Chris Mullin in his diaries chronicled the rise and fall of New Labour, offering a fascinating perspective on what life is actually like for an MP, and also an amusing insight into being a member of the Labour government. Last night at the Soho Theatre in London, the performance was followed by a debate about politics and the arts. We were there and managed to record some of the participants' thoughts about the arts and the play itself. We started by asking the show's artistic director, Steve Mamion, if getting the play made was a hard sell, as after all, political diaries aren't the most obvious subject matter.
Well, political diaries aren't conventionally dramatic, I suppose, but they sort of should be, shouldn't they?
Mm.
Do you know, these are the Antony and Cleopatras of the modern day, so their diaries and their journals should be the most exciting insight fly on the walls. Except I think what quite often happens with political diaries is they're written with an agenda in mind, and that agenda more often than not is what's my legacy and how is this going to be recorded, how is this going to place me in history. And I think what makes these diaries very special, and a couple of others, is that it's from a very innocent, very honest, this is how I saw it, and from the perspective of a flawed human being who was struggling with issues and struggling with the world he was making his way through, not written as a brief history of the 20th century by the person who shaped it.
The star of the show was without doubt John Hodgkinson, who played Chris Mullin. He was speaking on stage constantly for nearly 3 hours without once breaking character. We started by asking him how he prepared.
I'd already read the diaries before the idea of this play came up, and I was already a big fan of Chris Mullin, so when it became clear that the people were going to put this play on, I was very, very keen to become involved in it, because he's a hero of mine, and I think he should be a hero of everyone's.
Presumably you must have performed it in front of him at some point.
Oh, yes, yeah. he came to see a run-through in a rehearsal room just shortly before we put the play on. That was very frightening. But he was extremely generous, and I got a lot of confidence from that. I must say that I'm lucky that in that very few people know what he's like, so it doesn't matter how accurate my portrayal is, as long as it's got a sort of feel of authenticity about it. Of course, there's far more in the diaries. I'd recommend to everyone to read all three books of the diaries. They're fantastic. What we've got here is a tiny, tiny fillet of them.
We spoke to Channel 4 News' Michael Crick and asked him what he thought of the play, given that he'd reported it on many of the events chronicled.
I think the diaries are fantastic, but the play is even better. I mean, it's an extraordinary performance by John Hodgkinson. amazing energy and timing and speed and you know and the humour of it all and the rest of the cast and the impressions of those politicians. Mm. They're so uncannily accurate that it's been a wonderful evening out. And how John manages to do that, you know, for 2 hours, and today he did it twice. Extraordinary. So I hope as many people as can come to see it, and I'll certainly be telling all my political friends what a wonderful play it is. And I hope that you'll, you know, after you've been here at the Soho Theatre, you'll be able to take it round, you know, the rest of the country, and maybe come back to London as well.
We also asked the Shadow Health Minister and Michael Portillo's on-screen wife, Diane Abbott, if she expected to turn up on stage at any point.
No, not at all, because they don't really feature in the diaries. I've read all three diaries, and I think they're wonderful, and I think they've kind of resurrected the art of political diary writing. And it's so interesting, I think, the mix of culture and politics. And I think that both culture and politics have the capacity to change lives and change society. And I love both art forms, if you like.
You made a fascinating point during the debate afterwards about the role of philanthropy in funding the arts, given all the cuts. I was wondering if you could sort of summarise that for our audience, because I thought it was absolutely fascinating.
Well, basically, the government is, in real terms, cutting back on funding for the arts and arts education, obviously. And Jeremy Hunt, who's now the arts minister, is saying that he thinks philanthropy should take its place. Now, philanthropy is fine, but philanthropy is not going to want to fund black artists or younger artists or working-class artists, because philanthropy is basically about people giving money to confer social status. They want to give money to prestige things. So, I mean, I'm just worried about the reliance on philanthropy, because it tends to squeeze out the new, the young, the minority.
And Lib Dem MP Don Foster seemed to like the play too, as he explains.
But what did you make of the play this evening?
Fantastic. It's almost impossible to say more than that. I've read the diaries. I frankly didn't think it was going to be possible to bring them to life on stage. I've heard Chris read them on the radio. Bring them to life on stage, I really didn't think it was going to be possible. I was proved totally wrong. It was done brilliantly. Clearly it had to be carefully selected. The selection worked. It made the whole thing flow, but you still got a real sense of the torture that Chris Mullin went through, taking ministerial office, feeling that he was being neutered and all of those things, and also his real sense of frustration at not being able to achieve things that he would wanted to achieve and being part of a government that he didn't really entirely support. All of that came over absolutely brilliantly, brilliantly acted, a great evening.
Well, one of the recurring themes in the play was Chris Mullin constantly asking himself, am I making a difference?
Yeah.
As an MP, do you ever find yourself asking similar sort of questions?
All the time. And I mean, it's one of the biggest frustrations, and we had the sort of Q&A session afterwards, and I was saying that it is very difficult. Very often MPs are asked to help people, individuals with personal problems. Chris Mullin, example of refugee seekers, asylum seekers, that ended up being taken back out of the country, back to where they came from, probably to a life of real difficult poverty and so on, and the frustration he had. We deal with that all the time on that scale sometimes, but also much more more minor scale. Somebody gets wheel clamped unfairly. It's clear that they've unfairly been wheel clamped, and yet you can't get redress to them and so on. So it's from the relatively trivial, unimportant, but to the individual very important, to the very big ones, where there is a huge frustration. On the other hand, if we didn't do what we do, we wouldn't get some of the victories that we do achieve. And every single MP worth his or her salt should be able to say, and I certainly hope I can, that I have made a difference to the lives of individuals and I've made a difference to the way this country operates.
A Walk on Part, The Fall of New Labour, is on at the Soho Theatre in London until the 10th of December. And it's really, really good. And I'm hoping it will pave the way for Peter Mandelson's Technicolor Dreamcoat. Finally this week, Sean Ellis has been getting introspective and has been wondering if anyone out there actually really exists. To find out if he's right, well, here's Sean, of course, because if none of us exist, who else is it going to be?
Is there anybody out there in podcast land? Hello? I know that I get occasional feedback about stuff I do here on the Pod Delusion, but how do I actually know any of you exist? You only exist in words I think I hear. Or read. I'm in an interesting position. I'm fairly well off, but not so well off that I take everything for granted. I have a job I actively enjoy. I have a wife and kids that I love. I've never broken a bone. I can afford to get pizza whenever I want one. I have a pretty much perfect life. What are the chances against that? Of all the people I could have been, I'm one very lucky person. I could have been a penniless daughter of a subsistence farmer in southern India. I could have been born 1,000 years ago, condemned to a short, miserable life before succumbing to some dread childhood disease. I could have been an ice mole on the third moon of Jaglambita, fighting for survival against the parasitic wasp slugs as the long aphelion winter sets in. But I'm not. I'm spectacularly lucky. And this bothers me, because what are the chances? I have a theory that I'm so lucky because the universe revolves around me. Inside me, actually. You see, I'm going through one of my periodic flirtations with solipsism. And you, dear listener, will no doubt see what I mean. Unless, of course, I imagine that you won't. Solipsism is the stance that nothing except your own thoughts can be demonstrated to be real. It's easy to see that, in any objective way, we cannot really know that our senses are conveying real information at all. We may be living in a simulation as brains in jars, or just brain impulses in some kind of computing substrate, being fed a convenient fiction. How would we ever find out? Even worse, we may just be living in a world where we're making it all up ourselves, internally. By we here, of course, I mean me. All you imaginary folks just play along. The simulation idea is familiar from such films as The Matrix, in which we're invited to wonder whether Keanu Reeves' acting ability is in fact real or just a simulation. But the solipsism as internal monologue idea is best conveyed in the film Dark Star, a low-budget 1974 SF comedy which pokes fun at 2001. In the film, the artificially intelligent Bomb Number 20 is given an erroneous order, and it's up to one of the crew to persuade it not to explode while still attached to the ship.
What I'm getting at is this. The only experience that is directly available to you is your sensory data. And this sensory data is merely a stream of electrical impulses that stimulates your computing center.
In other words, all that I really know about the outside world is relayed to me through my electrical connections.
Exactly!
Why, that would mean that I really don't know what the outside universe is like at all, for certain.
That's it!
Intriguing. I wish I had more time to discuss this matter.
Why don't you have more time?
Because I must detonate in 75 seconds.
So here I am, wondering if I've got to where I am just by imagining it, tweaking the rules of my own game so that I win every time. Look, here I am even rambling on, and I imagine I'm on a top podcast being listened to by thousands of people. Unreal. So, my worthy apparences, how do we get around the logical impermeability of solipsism? Dr. Johnson, of dictionary fame, made a good stab at it. As Boswell wrote at the time, "After we came out of the church, we stood talking for some time together of Bishop Berkeley's ingenious sophistry to prove the non-existence of matter, and that everything in the universe is merely ideal. I observed that though we are satisfied his doctrine is not true, it is impossible to refute it. I shall never forget the alacrity with which Johnson answered, striking his foot with mighty force against a large stone till he rebounded from it. I refute it thus." Now, this argument is emotionally satisfying, but hardly satisfactory. His ideal foot would have connected with an ideal stone in exactly the same way, and yet this is probably the best argument that we have. The consistency of natural law, from the mundane behaviour of rocks to the unintuitive bits like quantum mechanics and the complex bits like turbulence and chaos theory, all go some way to undermining the notion that the world exists only in the imagination of one person. Particularly one as limited as me. If I were truly master of all destiny, physical and mental, I would surely bestride this world like a colossus. And to anyone who responded with, "But you do," your imaginary fiver is in the post. I would be able to mould matter, energy, and time to my will. I would find challenge in discovering the limits of my imagination, not in the limits of my execution. My DIY would be a lot better than it is now. Anyway, after all this, where am I now? In all actuality, in the same place I was to start with. Almost certainly, in a physical body, on a physical world in one tiny corner of a physical universe which, with the exception of a few other people who know me, is utterly indifferent to my existence. It's a worthy challenge to try and find out how it all works, but it's just as well it still looks like I'm right in the centre of it, though. Otherwise, I might go mad. This is Sean Ellis, imagining that he is reporting for the Pod Delusion.
And that's it for this week's show, so do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can download 2 years of podcast archives, as well as listen to extended interviews and related lectures and all that sort of thing, as well as like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. That's all at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion is also broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM in the London area at 11 a.m. on Sundays, if you're into that sort of thing. Now, if you like the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, why not subscribe for £5 or £10 a month to enable us to keep doing this sort of thing? You can find links to do so, as well as to make one-off donations, at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, one last thing. We've got a world-exclusive interview with Fenton, the dog that chased all of those deer across Richmond Park and became an internet sensation overnight. So, Fenton, thank you very much for joining us. So, what's it been like being the centre of all this media attention? So, have you let the fame go to your head? Fenton! 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 Jesus Christ! Fenton! Fenton! The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Cash Farouk, James Firth, Salim Fadley, Matt Kaiser, Pete Haig, Liz Luckendorf, Sean Ellis, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The role of Fenton was played by Molly and by Lucky, with thanks to Dave and to Hayley Stevens for supplying the dogs. The Sketch in the Moment is brought to you by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Right, we've got a flap on. The Godbotherers have been complaining about our new ad for Lynx Axe.
But it's not for them, Rupert. It's for desperate young men on the hunt for Rumpy Pumpy.
Clive, oh Clive. You know that, I know that. But no one's told them.
Can't we do what we always do? Just say we understand their position and respect their point of view, then disregard anything they say and carry on? It's worked before.
No, it's gone too far this time. The Advertising Standards Authority have banned the adverts completely.
Can they do that?
Apparently. So what's the next move? If we can't have scantily dressed pouting angels smashing their halos and looking like they're about to hump the bejesus out of one young man, well, what can we do?
Sex sells. What else can be done?
Well, it's a long shot, but we could always tell the truth.
What? New Lynx Axe? Marginally better than the smell of sweat?
Maybe that is going too far. Why don't we push the fact that the new can is going to be much larger and therefore better value for money?
We could, and its new hydrating qualities really do have excellent moisturising effects.
Oh, and let's not forget the new fragrance, which has immediate impact as it diffuses in the air around you.
Yes, this could work. Let's sell the benefits. So, what do we have?
Well, putting that together, the slogan must be... Our new 12-incher keeps you wet as it explodes on your face.
Excellent. I can't see anyone having a problem with that.